Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Coming up on 2 minutes past the hour, welcome to a brand new broadcast week on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the entrance to the chat room. Folks wandering in even now as we speak. Good evening to Jan, to Patrick, to Cynthia. Sparky is in there. Longtime moderator both of the Horn chat room and the Horn Malloy Skype chat group. Also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will find the Listen Live button, an easy way to get the stream. If you're on, however, a mobile device or a tablet, a smart something or another, we recommend the apps from Stitcher and TuneIn. They both work quite well. Also there at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will find, of course, the PayPal button. And the traditional overland mail address, the latter being The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V 25801. A reminder that checks and money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, as that leaves Boss Man Wayne unable to do anything with them. They should instead be made to The Horn or Head On Communication. Like that. And as we begin this this broadcast week, here on this ninth day of December 2013, wet, cold, sloppy, we got a little bit of snow over the weekend. We, up until about an hour ago, were in a $50 hole for December thus far. Bethany jumped in and took care, as soon as I posted that, Bethany jumped in, Beth did, and took care of $25 of it. So we are in, we begin the week in a $25 hole with, I might add, Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge on the table. And that means that Shirley in Wisconsin has generously provided, as she does once a month, $150 if either 15 folks at $10 apiece, or two folks at 75, or three at 50, or 10 at 15, you get the idea. If everybody else will kick in and match the $150, then she'll double it. So that's a way to get us out of the $25 hole and to the good, actually, starting this broadcast week. Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge is on the table, and the PayPal button is easy to find at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Now, it is the beginning of the broadcast week, and that's kind of a special undertaking, seeing as how the weekend precedes Monday. It affords the opportunity for all kinds of right-wing tomfoolery, chicanery, idiocy, and moranity, most importantly, to sort of pile up, so that we got a lot to work with on a Monday. That's right, it's Moran Monday on the Horn. Step right up. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up, step right up. You will not believe your ears. Behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas, you will find right-wing morans, teabagging morans, libertarian morans, did I mention teabagging morans, Fundamentalist religion, industry, morons, morons of all stripe, all kind, all morons. Yes, indeed, for less than 5 cents per hour of programming, you will not believe your ears themselves. You can't tell the morons without a program, and this is the program that tells the morons. You just can't tell them much. We advise people to hang on to their various and sundry bags and wallets, as the morons, when you go through the Moran Monday tent, can get a little bit grabby. Head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in morons. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You know, we began last Moran Monday, if I recall correctly, with a recitation of the various and sundry right-wing objections to Pope Frank, who said that maybe money ought not be worshipped as a god, as it so often is in this country and others. That maybe there was something more to life than merely grubbing away and eating, excreting, and dying. Now, what he thinks there's more of and what I think there's more of, that's subject to debate and discussion. But I tend to agree with him that left to the tender mercies of capitalism and free market economics and things that are supposed to dribble down, bad things can happen to a lot of people who aren't necessarily fully vested in the billionaire games. So with that as a reminder, it was the remarks that Dr. Bill, in fact, was talking about during his program just a couple of hours ago. Evangelii Gaudium. That's where Pope Frank's remarks came from. And so we start the week with a sort of reboot of things that make right-wingers, teabaggers, libertarians, repiglicans, fundamentalist religion industry morons. It makes them all just completely lose what little bit is left of their tiny minds that are comprised of really big lizard brains. What do I mean? I mean the passing, as of Thursday, of Nelson Mandela. Or Mandela. Or, yeah, but never Mandela. No, he passed away at the ripe old age of 95 years old on Thursday. And this set the wing nutosphere aloft. They were raised up by their own lighter than air, dumber than dirt, gaseous breaths. What do I mean? Well, oh goodness me, there's so many of them. For instance, there's Sandy Rios, and she is a radio blatherskate now. She's sort of second banana to Brian Fisher of the American Family Association Radio Network, Tupelo, Mississippi, Stan. And, well, her not like Nelson Mandela real good, her don't. He said. Cue, there she goes. Or not.
Nelson Mandela was placed in prison because of the violence that he did in the country of South Africa. Now, you can argue, I guess, you could say, well, it was worth it because now we overthrew apartheid.
I guess apartheid was bad. I guess it's a bad thing to disenfranchise and demonize and dehumanize an entire majority population of a country. I guess. If you pull her string a second time, does she say math is hard?
I don't know. I mean, is...
Neither do I.
Is that really the way a victory should be won?
No, Sandy, no. The way you win a victory is by stealing elections. Right? In the name of Jesus? Like your side does? Oh, that's me, not me.
Is this really a righteous cause? Is he really a saint for doing this?
Somewhere out there, members of the Horn family have already, barely 11 minutes into this Moran Monday program, begun kicking furniture. Sandy Rios doesn't know if it was worth letting Nelson Mandela out of prison to end apartheid. She doesn't know. I mean, I guess. Oh, my Lord. It gets better, though. Or dumber. Or worse. Depending on how you look at it.
And they talk about, you know, him being in solitary confinement. Well, criminals are placed in solitary confinement. If you murder other people, you lose your rights.
How do you even begin to dispute with such indisputable wisdom? I mean, they weren't putting him in that hellhole prison because he was a political dissident, or because they were trying to maintain the white power structure, or no, he was a criminal. You know, the funny thing is, let's play replace the word.
Is this really a righteous cause? Is he really a saint for doing this? I mean, they talk about him being crucified. Well, criminals are crucified. If you break the law, you get crucified.
Is there any doubt that these well-funded, wealthy, lobster-for-lunch-eating, right-wing religion industry repig-lickens would be standing there in the crowd hollering, "Crucify him!" if we could just build the time machine and take him back?
Nah, you lose your rights.
I don't view it as sainthood. I'm sorry, maybe I'm the only one on the planet who doesn't, but I don't. And I think the truth has to be told. Now, I don't...
Oh, wait. Okay, so she doesn't view it as sainthood, but she thinks the truth has to be told. And I guess, lucky for us, Sandy Rios, Moran, has the truth? Or is that what we're to understand from this little bit of babalicious goodness?
I don't know what happened with Nelson Mandela during his 28 years of imprisonment. They will say that he came out, you know, wanting to work with both sides, and he stepped down. He only held his office, I think, for two terms and then stepped down. That was a very noble thing to do. Perhaps he had a life.
Perhaps. He can't even get a straight up, "That was a very noble thing to do." Perhaps. I bet there wouldn't have been a perhaps there if he'd been a white man. Well, such a cynic.
Change in prison. But if he did, I haven't heard that or seen that in writing. Have you? I would like to know that, if he changed tremendously. And I would also say that from the South Africans that I have encountered in the last few years...
I think by changed tremendously, she means became lighter skin toned. And I don't know. Do African leaders fade in prison? Sandy Rios wants to know. She doesn't know.
And I can't say that there's pages and pages of them, but there have been a handful of them that I've met around the world when I've been traveling. I don't think the picture of South Africa, as it stands now, is what the narrative is.
Huh? Wes, Edith, huh?
I don't think the picture of South Africa now is what the narrative is. Does this woman have, like, Campbell's alphabet soup for lunch and just write her monologue out of it? Yeah, just throw it up against the wall. We'll see what sticks.
It's certainly, to be a white person in South Africa is not a very fun thing right now.
To be a white person in South Africa is not a very fun thing right now. Because, after all, that is the standard of justice in the world today. Is it fun to be you? Well, it's obviously very fun to be Sandy Rios. Lots of fun. I mean, there you sit in Tupelo, Mississippi, Stan, and whether you make any sense or not, they write you a check and you make the long walk down to once a week, twice, who knows? A couple of things Dr. John is pointing out. Sandy Rios has to guess apartheid was bad because it was people like her that benefited from it. White and privileged and right wing. So, you know, she guesses it was bad. Get her nice and liquored up and she'd say the same about slavery. Dr. John adds, let's see. Nelson Mandela fought occupiers, served as president, and then stepped down after two terms. And that's not enough for Sandy Rios. Why does Sandy Rios hate George Washington? See, that's what I was thinking about. Charlie Pierce pointed out the other day that in terms of opposing colonial occupiers, it really gets started, well, actually it gets started with native peoples, but when the white peoples get into it, it starts with George Washington. And after we started this country, he served as president for two terms, even though there were some among the framers and founders who were willing to hand him a freaking crown. And then he stepped down and went back to his plantation in the model of the old Roman noble Quincinatus, for whom Cincinnati is named, by the way. Quincinatus. And so, yeah, stepping down after two terms is statesmanlike. And you get the sense that Nelson Mandela, having pushed for democracy, justice, equality, would not be setting a very good example by, becoming maximum South African dictator for life. You see how it works. By the way, many thanks going out to Patrick and to Sal and to Jeremy. They got us started on Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge this evening, and we now have only $130 to go to meet Shirley's challenge for this evening. So thanks very much for getting us started, Jeremy. With a note, Jeremy says, "In lieu." Instead, okay, as well as kicking inanimate objects, I have sent money the Horn's way. Thank you for addressing these freaks. I dealt with a few of them this weekend regarding this very thing. Mandela is and was a terrorist. And effers, says Jeremy. Well, let's let Sandy Rios wrap up.
I'll tell you that. And maybe many of you think it's as it should be. But I don't think they have reached racial reconciliation in the way it's being presented. I think that they have now obtained suppressing the white population with the black population holding the superior vantage point. So that's how I see what's happening in the last 24 hours. And I don't think Nelson Mandela was a saint. Nelson Mandela was placed in...
Nice, huh? And that's just a representative sample. There's sort of a continuum here between the people who hate Nelson Mandela hate his memory, hate the end of apartheid, all of that. And then next to that, there's what happened to Newt Gingrich this weekend. Newt Gingrich, if you remember back to the, if you're old enough to remember, back to the, or maybe you've learned the history of, back to the end of the apartheid movement and the divestiture effort and the protests. Newt Gingrich, of all people, was a member of the House of Representatives at the time, and he tried, and here in this moment where one wants to faintly praise Newt Gingrich, one also must remember that he said earlier today or over the weekend or something that Nelson Mandela's death is just another reason for people to bash on Republicans, because, like, we're hard-pressed for reasons. But no, he said that Ronnie Reagan, the B-movie actor, should have been more forceful in dealing with the apartheid regime of the 80s. And so, with Nelson Mandela's death, he wrote the following on his Facebook page. Big mistake, Newt. You really don't have any idea who it is that follows you, do you? You really don't know about the teabaggers. You just wanted them to vote for you for president, right, Newt? So he writes, President Nelson Mandela was one of the greatest leaders of our lifetime. He emerged from 27 long years in prison with a wisdom, a compassion, and a commitment to helping other people that was astonishing. His life was a triumph of the human spirit. When he visited the Congress, I was deeply impressed with the charisma and the calmness with which he could dominate a room. It was as if the rest of us grew smaller, and he grew stronger and more dominant the longer the meeting continued. His thoughtful, disciplined, but friendly and warm personality made him a leader who could define the right policies and the right behaviors. Nelson Mandela was truly the father of an integrated, democratic South Africa. He will be an inspiration for generations to come and an historic leader worth studying for as long as people want to learn about greatness in serving others. Callista and I extend our condolences and our prayers to the Mandela family and to the people of South Africa. Okay? Pretty straightforward. Not damning with faint praise. And for Newt Gingrich, about as forthright as the man is capable of being. At that point in time, his Facebook page was descended upon by morons, like you wouldn't expect them to, right? No. Salon cataloged these various and sundry Facebook posts. Check them out. Newt, I was rooting for you to win the primaries and become the next president. Please tell me you're joking. 2 exclamation points. Mandela was a commie murderer. Or a commie murderer. I don't know exactly what Cletus there means. I don't know if he murdered communists or... Such an amazing rewrite of history since 1962 and 1990. Newt, I thought you, of all people, a historian, and amateur paleontologist, I might add, would be true to who this guy really was. Because, you know, Eustace there in Pig Vomit, Georgia, well, he knows who that Mandela guy really was. Another friend of the GOP. He hated America, Newt. Quit pandering to the blacks. They get him out there commenting on the blogs early in Pig Vomit, Georgia. And then this, Standard PC response. Grow a pair, Newt.
Pair of what? Shoes? Shorts? Socks?
Oh, I see here. Emery here is asserting that because he said decent things about Nelson Mandela, that Newt Gingrich no longer possesses manly testicles. Ah. And then, this is what our kids are being taught in the school system. ... All propaganda. ... Is it any wonder why we are in the shape we are in? ... I think you missed one there. The thinking of the people, equal sign, the leadership we have today, ... We have passed, P-A-S-T, the point of no return, ... If your kid, Y-O-U-R, he got that one right, can leave college without becoming a flaming liberal, ... all caps, it will be a miracle, ... Thank you for that, Clyde. Then this. At least Mandela made no bones about who I was, unlike our current prez, Hell, we have a commie/socialist, Marxist, Muslim now. This is the loyal opposition. Well, Newt is not one to take that sort of thing lying down. He fired back. Yesterday, I issued a heartfelt and personal statement about the passing of President Nelson Mandela. I said that his family and his country would be in my prayers and Callista's prayers. I was surprised by the hostility and vehemence of some of the people who reacted to me saying a kind word about a unique historic figure. So let me say to those conservatives who don't want to honor Nelson Mandela, what would you have done? I would ask of his critics, where were some of these conservatives as allies against tyranny? Where were the masses of conservatives opposing apartheid? Finally, if you had been imprisoned for 27 years, 18 of them in a cell 8 foot by 7 foot, how do you think you would have emerged? Would you have been angry? Would you have been bitter? Nelson Mandela emerged from 27 years in prison as an astonishingly wise, patient, and compassionate person. He called for reconciliation among the races. He invited his prison guard to sit in the front row at his inauguration as president. In effect, he said to the entire country, "If I can forgive the man who imprisoned me, surely you can forgive your neighbors." And then turned around, Gingrich did, and said that that the death of Mandela would be used as a means by which to criticize Republicans. Well, doesn't that kind of conduct rather beg for criticism? And then from the don't quite got that whole comparison thing nailed down just yet department, we get this. And I warn you, it's a Lulu.
So apparently there is some online TV wingnut cast thingy that is called The Dove TV. The host of The Dove TV was interviewing some dude named Jack Cashel, who is the recent author of a tome of letters strung together in things that might possibly appear to be words called If I Had a Son, Race, Guns, and the Railroading of George Zimmerman. Man, with the title of that, you know where it's going, don't you? Well, here we go. Enjoy.
A couple of weeks ago, Eric Holder, U.S. attorney, basically saying the investigation's not over. He's still going after Zimmerman. What in the world can he go after him for?
You know, they're trying to, you know, right after the trial, I mean, literally the day after the verdict came in, he spoke to the NAACP in Orlando, which is just 20 miles from Sanford, Florida. And he told them, you know, because they were all upset and angry because they've been stirred up by the media, which was misreporting, corrupting the case from the beginning. And he said, well, no, this isn't over yet. We still can get him on federal civil rights charges. Yeah, you could, I suppose. But George Zimmerman was may have been the least racist person in the state of Florida.
Really? The guy who guns down the kid in the hoodie for the summarily executable offense of carrying iced tea and Skittles is the least racist person in Florida. Wow. Yeah, I think I'm going to check those Florida vacation plans off. Then again, you never know when somebody in Florida is going to start standing their ground. This cup of coffee's cold. You know? And I know you do. By the way, thank you, Jeremy, for the kind words. Jeremy by email. Email address, by the way, bobkincaid@gmail.com, bobkincaid@gmail.com. Notes, I love, and I do mean love, your grammar Nazi ways. LMAO, endless laughs at these MFers. Jim says, I think they need a spelling bee. What about it? What good's a spelling bee if they're going to hang 19 exclamation points after every word, Jim? The problem is much deeper. Much deeper. Marty asking, Mandela was a Muslim? Really? Yeah, I know. And then there's Jan in the UK who says, subject line, South Africa. Why do so many white people from the UK go to South Africa to get away from our winters if they're treated so badly over there? That female is just pig ignorant. And I think, Jan, you're being a little rough on the pigs. Then again, Sandy Rios has probably never been more than 15 miles away from Tublo, Mississippistan, or wherever the hell it is. Nah, she's been all over this country, but she's not, you know, she's not going to South Africa. She might get necklaced down there. I mean, Jan, you just said that the white people from the UK go to South Africa to get away from the winter. You didn't say they come back. You can't sneak anything past me. No. And thanks to Asa. Asa has now taking us down to $110 to go to meet Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. Thank you very much, Asa. It would be very nice to get the week off to a rousing start. Thank you very kindly. So that's 11 folks at 10 bucks, and I'm not doing any other division or math. No. 11 folks, $10, and we can happily meet Shirley's Wisconsin challenge. So thank you. But we're not, oh, sweet Jesus, we're not done. We're not even done with these goobs.
After, when the Justice Department came into the case, you know, a month after the shooting, they sent a whole swarm of FBI agents down to Sanford to interview anyone who was ever anything to do with George Zimmerman, and they couldn't find a single person who had ever even heard him tell so much as a racial joke. Not only that, at the time of the shooting, he was mentoring two black teenagers. He had been, as I mentioned earlier, just a year earlier, had taken the lead in the case to get justice for a black homeless man who had been punched out by the white son of a police lieutenant.
Wait. It's only fair. I have to give you a second to sort of get things in order, make sure there's nothing, you're not going to knock a glass of water onto an electric space heater or anything if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. No, because it's on the way. This is all about George Zimmerman, remember?
It's like going after Nelson Mandela on civil rights, or Mother Teresa. I mean, this is as vain a case as there could be.
You got that? George Zimmerman now enters the pantheon of people who are just like Nelson Mandela. Last Friday, it was Rick Brofromix, Frothy Mixture, Santorum, declaring himself just like Nelson Mandela. And now it's George Effin Zimmerman. Whew. 38 minutes in and... Nope, I forgot the tequila this weekend. At this point, Robitussin might have to do. Really? George Zimmerman. Just like Nelson Mandela. Isn't that something? Yeah, I thought so too. There's just... It goes on and on. And just, okay, you get a break now because there's not actual audio to this. We take you now to Larry Klayman. You might recall that Larry Klayman is the teabagger who is trying to get somebody to gin up a real nice, top-notch little coup d'etat and overthrow the civilian government of the United States by removing Barack Obama from office. I wish I could. You know what? It's a little bit disturbing to me that I can even say something like that and not just give up, walk away from the microphone and say, F it! But 3 days ago, December the 6th, a day that will live in illiteracy, Larry Klayman published over to the Wingnut Daily a column that was titled "The Second American Revolution Has Begun." I thought that was the Civil War, but That's what they were calling it at the time. Exclusive, Larry Klayman makes plans for Third Continental Congress in Philadelphia. And he writes things like, there was no mistaking how significant Jefferson and his colleagues believed the scale of the American struggle to be. One of Jefferson's duties in Philadelphia was the design of a seal for the new nation, a task he shared with Benjamin Franklin and John Adams. He's quoting from John Meekham's book at this point. And how, I guess, after a couple of jugs of wine, reacting to a proposal of Franklin's that invoked the parting of the Red Sea, Jefferson suggested Pharaoh sitting in an open chariot, a crown on his head, and a sword in his hand, passing through the divided waters of the Red Sea, the Sea of Reeds, if you actually read Hebrew, which I don't, but I've been informed by those who do that I may reliably understand to be the actual translation. Anyway, yada yada, Moses, Moses, Moses. Right. So he quotes at extreme length the Meekham book and says, in short, what Meekham is describing, there's nothing short about it. That's paragraph after paragraph of John Meekham's work simply lifted wholesale, but who's counting? In short, what Meekham is describing is an unbridled optimism that freedom and its attendant prosperity and well-being, free from excessive debt, will revert to the colonies once the governmental bondage placed upon them by King George and his corrupt parliament are removed with the help of God's divine intervention and grace. Awesome. The parallels to the even direr... Really? Direr? Anybody want to help? D-I-R-E-R? Wouldn't that be even more dire? See, within this pale flesh yet beats the heart of a guy who was born to be a copy editor. And probably a pain in the ass one at that. I found this over at Raw Story earlier today and tweeted it. Because it made me want to run screaming into the cold, cold winter. Just going to read you the headline, never mind the story. Because this is like a little mini nomination. And for some reason or another, I catch these over at Raw Story all the time. Now, I'm going to read it slowly. No funny accents. My good Midwestern broadcast standard, right, yeah. Navy promoted officer who admitted molesting daughter in lieu of investigation. Yeah. Apparently, a Navy officer was promoted who admitted that he had molested his daughter instead of being investigated. What is it? Navy promoted officer who admitted molesting daughter in lieu of investigation. I think I know what they mean to say, but what they mean to say isn't what they said. They said Navy promoted officer who admitted molesting daughter in lieu of investigation. You know, you'd think going all the way back to the hunting of the Cleanus in the 1990s that we would have learned by now, as the Republicans told us time and time and time and time again, words mean things. Navy promoted officer who... I only see these things because of my parents, whom I continue to love and miss to this day. And moments like this, I saw that this morning, And even though somebody that you love may have been gone for a very long time, the essential nature of your relationship will still bear out from time to time. Because I wanted to take the laptop and go, because there's this little moment where you don't realize, wait, they're not here. Because I wanted to take it and run into the living room where Mom and Dad would be sitting there going, read this, read it now, hand it to Mother, who it's, oh my, and she would pass it over to Dad, who would say something like, whoever wrote that couldn't pass Minnie Lee Hugert's ninth grade journalism class. And Mother would say, no, couldn't, just couldn't. And they would both begin laughing. Navy promoted officer who admitted molesting daughter in lieu of investigation. I think if I were the daughter, I would have preferred the investigation. But anyway, back to Larry Klayman. Moran. To seek redress for our grievances as our forefathers attempted leading up to Independence Day on July 4th, 1776, the Reclaim America Now Coalition gave notice in front of the White House on November 19th of this year. They were expecting 1 million people. They got like 12. 12 people, not 12 million. That if the people's freedoms were not restored by the day after Thanksgiving, the Second American Revolution would begin in earnest. Ernest is apparently a little town with maybe a truck stop in it somewhere in Arkansas. True to the predictions of anyone living in our times, our grievances went unanswered by our legitimate government usurper. I hope this is not a brain disorder or something that I'm having where I've quit understanding it. True to the prediction... broadcast voice. True to the predictions of anyone living in our times, our grievances went unanswered by our legit... Got to get it right, Bob. True to the predictions of anyone living in our times, our grievances went unanswered by our illegitimate government usurpers. Because the legitimate government usurpers were busy that day? And now we must make good on our threats of nonviolent civil disobedience to attempt redress. Oh boy, I can't wait to see what passes for nonviolent civil disobedience by a bunch of people with guns. And then this. Oh yes, then this. In this regard, as we mourn the death this week of Nelson Mandela, a great man who, like his American counterpart Martin Luther King, used civil disobedience successfully to bring freedom to his people, and by definition, all people, who are created equal with certain unalienable rights, as Jefferson put it, unquote. Let us take Mandela's achievement in liberating South Africa from bondage as a further example of what we can accomplish in freeing our own nation from the choking, despotic, governmental slavery of Obama and his pliant Democratic and Republican minions in Congress and the judiciary. I got to get back to D.C. Things have apparently changed since July. Now the Republicans in the Congress have become pliant. I gotta call Bo. Tell him we can expect the AIC Act will pass any minute now, because, I mean, the Republicans in the Congress are pliant, and they're minions now of Barack Obama. How you liking that, John Boehner, minion of Barack Obama? Have you had that put on the plaque on your door yet? No? Really? Get with it, buddy. Stand not upon the order if you're going, but go at once. Yeah. Larry Klayman is going to overthrow that one in his White House, just like Nelson Mandela. I feel like I have bugs crawling all over my skin just from having said that. You guys, Steve just wrote in, I just bit through a granite tennis ball sculpture. No, no, you gotta use the real one, Steve. The granite ones are awful damn hard on the dentition. Now that's Steve writing from New York City at 6:40 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Within 2 minutes, Rob had written from the Twin Cities, Bob, thanks for the tennis ball tip a while back, and I'm sure the neighbors appreciate it too. And Dr. John, under the subject line, your history of word knowing. Bravo, words mean things. And remember Orwell's essay on language. Garbled writing is a sign of garbled thinking, and reading nonsense makes us think nonsensically. But there's, I guess there's a sort of corollary to that, Dr. John. What happens when you don't know you're garbled, and you don't know you're writing garbled language, and you don't know that you're thinking nonsensically? Is it not sort of a priori that therefore you think you're the one, that they would think that they're the ones with the that are making sense? Because I got a bunch of this. I mean, it burns as us, the stupid does. Dang. I mean, tons of it. And I don't know what it is about the Pope or Nelson Mandela dying? Well, yeah, I do know. I kind of think I do know. What sends these ignorant, addle-pated freaks into moron overdrive is that in every moment when their privilege and their status quo is challenged, and it's not even theirs, is it? It's more like they are defenders of the status quo and the privilege of someone else. Because in this country, if you're not... Well, what did Ronald Reagan say? In this country, if you're not making $1 million a year, you're poor. But everything within the framework of what Dr. Bill O'Brien was talking about a couple of weeks about back, the paranoid style in American politics, everything that does not appeal directly to the paranoia is a conspiracy and or a threat. You want some proof? I got some proof. Right out of the halls of the Congress of the United States. It was just a few days ago. Fair Immigration Reform Movement firm showed up in Washington, D.C. with some children in tow, ostensibly to teach the children the workings of the ways of government and the fact that when one does have grievances, one has the right to petition for the redress of them. Firm and the children were studiously avoided, especially by Republicans in the House. Eventually, they found their way to the offices of John Boehner, and Eric Cantor. Leave Britney alone. They had the temerity to walk into Eric Cantor's office. This is what transpired. You got it? This is about not splitting up families over idiotic laws that split families up. Because this is a cruel and barbaric place in many ways, but especially when it comes to the treatment of immigrants. Right? So there's some milling around. Children wearing T-shirts saying, keep my family together.
Don't lock the hallway. Get the hallway open. Okay, guys. How's everybody doing?
This would be a member of the Capitol Police. That's right. Eric Cantor's office called the Capitol Police on a group of children singing, keep our families together.
Good, fantastic. Thanks.
Hey, yeah.
Would you want to leave?
Yeah, they would like to meet with the congressman. I've informed them several times they have to do that through email.
Okay.
Unfortunately, they don't want to do that, so they've said they don't want to meet with the staffer, which we've also offered them.
Okay.
And I think they want to wait here until the congressman.
Okay. Guys, unfortunately, like you said, you got to set the appointment through the congressman through email. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you got to get an appointment through email. You can't just walk into some congressman's goddamned office and request an appointment with the congressman. Oh, no. He's got important things he's doing. More important than, you know, immigrant families.
You're going to have to leave now. Is there anybody here planning on getting arrested today? Or is this all just peaceful demonstration?
Peaceful.
Okay. All right. We have to ask you to come out because they've asked you to leave. If you want to have an appointment, you can have an appointment. So please, sure. If you don't mind, I understand. I've heard what you guys are doing. I appreciate what you're doing. But they can only do so much also. If the congressman can't meet with you right now, they can't meet with you. So please send it up through email, okay? Please don't sing again, guys. We have to ask you to leave, and we don't want to leave. Guys, go ahead and move out. I'm going to close the door, okay? So you guys want to stay in? You're subject to arrest. If you
want
to go out,
okay. We want it now.
Well, you guys stay in. It's up to you. If you want to leave, you can leave now. If not, okay. Are you going to go out? Let me know, guys.
Hold on.
I'm giving you a chance. If you want to leave, leave now. Guys. So we're not going to do it. I understand your call. You guys are doing a great job. I understand. You have a choice. You guys want to leave now, or you will be subject to arrest if you stay in this room. Okay, so please, I appreciate your call. We're asking you to leave. If you refuse to leave, everybody that stays in this room may be arrested. Okay? Sorry, Snyder, my fault. It's up to you guys. What do you want to do? I'm giving you. Okay, come on up. I understand. I appreciate it.
all these guys don't want to leave. So, quick them. Yep. It's your choice, guys.
Yeah. I'd like you to leave and you're on camera.
We'd like you to give this
Sorry, sure you want to stay too?
I'm going to leave.
Okay, we'll go ahead and leave now, guys. I need to clear the way and let people out. Okay, we understand.
So, they did begin to leave. A little bit later, some six children made their way over to the office of, Pliant Minion John Boehner. Where he had his staff boldly lock their door to keep those pesky people from coming through it to say that they didn't want him to break up and destroy their families, which, of course, the Republican Party says that it values above all things, except money, I mean, you know. Outside the door, the children began singing, "We pray for Speaker Boehner to bring a bill to a vote," to the tune of "We Wish You a Merry Christmas." That's when the Capitol Police showed up again and shouted that singing is not allowed in the capital of the United States of America, and that he, by God, would arrest those children if they kept singing. Dr. John notes, you know, in fairness, Cantor is a molybdenum kind of guy. He hears we're titanium and gets all froggy. Yeah. But in all seriousness, Dr. John says, wait, did the Capitol cop just ask a bunch of kids, does anyone plan to get arrested today? Why does Eric Cantor hate children? God, wouldn't it be fun if we had a bunch of progressive megaphones that could follow, that could ask that question out in the wider world? Why does Eric Cantor hate children? Well, he doesn't hate children generally, he just hates, you know, those children. And yes, Marty asked the same question. Did I hear that correctly? Does anyone plan on getting arrested today? Actually, that part is SOP in that environment. Instead of just coming in and cracking skulls, they will ask, because you, in many instances where there is civil disobedience taking place, or some sort of protest-oriented direct action, not everybody in the room is willing to risk arrest. And so in that circumstance, knowing how it works, the Capitol Police comes in and they say, does anyone here plan on getting arrested today? If you're not planning on getting arrested, please leave, and we'll arrest the people who plan on getting arrested. And then they tell you three times to leave, and if you don't leave, they come and arrest you. It is stylized, I think, is the best way to put it. Steve noting, you know, if the First Amendment doesn't extend to Congress, where the fuck does it extend to? But see, Steve, this is one of those lawful time, place, and manner statutes that trumps the First Amendment, apparently. It's not a prior restraint. But it does say that not everywhere can, that the government has a right to impose upon your right to free speech under certain circumstances. Meanwhile, if Glenn Beck decides to incite his listeners to go and shoot up some foundation that he has unilaterally declared to be progressive, he can say, well, how could I possibly know? See what I mean when I said we had a bunch of morons today? Right. All right. So let's take a break and get the conversation started for this Moran Monday. You know the number, 304-658-3333. On Skype, the handle is Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. Bob Kincaid Horn. Either way works fine by me. Thank you. Thank you to those of you who have helped out thus far, helping dig us out of the hole and then helping us get started on Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. Thanks going out to Beth, to Patrick, to Sal, to Jeremy, and to Asa. We are $110 away from meeting Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge, and your help is what it takes to get there, and it is deeply, deeply appreciated, because that is what helps us make sure that there will be a horn in January after there's a horn in December. So thank you. Light them up, and we'll be conversating soon. Because this is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Immigration scene, shining and feeling clean. Could it be a sin? I got stopped by the immigration man. Said he doesn't know if he can. Let me in. Let me in. Immigration man, can I cross the line and pray I can stay another day? His immigration face, giving me a paper chase, but the sun was coming, 'cause all at once, it looked into my face, stamped a number over my face, and it sent me running. Won't you let me in, immigration man, can I cross the line and pray, I can stay another day? My immigration form, it's big enough to keep me warm when the cold wind's coming. So go where you will, long as you think you can. You better watch out for the man. Anywhere you're going, come on and let me in. Immigration man, can I cross the line and pray? Take your fingers from the train.
I thought that appropriate. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Immigration Man. And, lines are open, 304-658-3333. Before we go to the phone lines, just a couple of other Moran moments to flesh out the nominee card for this evening. Are you familiar, and you probably sadly are, with Representative Ted Yoho, of Florida, Stan? Yeah, probably so. December 14th. Looking at the calendar here. Yeah, December 14th is this Saturday. December 14th will be 1 year since Adam Lanza went in with weapons of great destruction and began chopping children into tiny pieces at Sandy Hook Elementary School. There will be commemorations, there will be vigils, there will be remembrances. But Ted Yoho won't be at any of them. No. At 2 p.m. in Lake City, Florida, Ted Yoho is going to be hosting a family firearm safety event. He, which means some idiotic right-wing staffer, posted on his Facebook page, "Oh my God, Congressman Ted Yoho, proudly serving Florida's 3rd District, without so much as a brain cell to call his own, family firearm safety event. Please bring your family and kids for an educational event on gun safety, purchasing firearms, legal requirements, and safety standards, while encouraging responsible firearm ownership with Congressman Ted Yoho." It's language night, isn't it? I didn't mean for it to be, but it are. Please bring your family and kids for an educational event on gun safety, purchasing firearms, and safety standards while encouraging responsible firearm ownership with Congressman Ted Yoho. Anybody want to sort that one for me? Gran? I don't remember how to diagram sentences. I don't think you could diagram that one in the first place. Saturday, December 14th, at the Jackie Taylor Building, 128 Southwest Burley Avenue, off West Highway 90, Lake City, Florida, 2 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. This event is free and open to the public. Public, yeah. Of course, Yoho's office is saying, "Well, it ain't no commemoration of the Sandy Hook. We's just thinking that if they'd been some freedom protecting Second Amendment remedy toting folks from up there to that school, well, Wolverines, that kid probably wouldn't have got away with killing nearly if they just had some men's." Remember all that? Yeah, me too. If you think that's a coincidence, but then again, isn't some other gun goober group planning on having a gun rally right there in, Newtown, Connecticut? Yeah. The morans ye have always with ye. Always and forever. All right. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Oh, Jesus.
No, it's Bob.
That halo around your head confused me.
Oh, okay. What do you say, Bill?
Yes. Man, you got me going tonight with the one after another of these, the pig lickers. You brought a quote to mind from a great blues singer, a guy that Willie Rice Miller, which no relative of mine, and he known as Sonny Will Williamson II. He used the name the second time. And one of his lines he used a lot was, if I can quote it correctly, it was, "Lots of people talking, but a mighty few people know. And one after another tonight, you know, with the talk of this situation, that situation, the cop in the Congress, it's like one after another you heard people talking and not saying much of anything that was knowable. Well, I'll tell you what, old Gingrich actually gained a couple points. How do you do that?
Yeah, but he backtracked.
Yeah, right away he has to backtrack on it.
Yeah, Mandela's death is just another excuse for the left to smear Reagan.
Jeez. They didn't have to work too hard at that. Reagan kept smearing himself with actions of one type or the other. I don't know. I just give up. You know, and this, again, talking about the Sandy Hook, that guy wasn't related to Mario, was he?
We can hope not.
I would hope not.
His mama was Mother Lanza, and his and she was estranged and divorced from his father, who was some sort of Wall Street bankster type.
Oh, so he wasn't any high class pop singer then, yeah.
No.
Okay, because I remember hearing a lot of that when I was a kid. One of the teachers I had in school liked him a lot and would put a lot of his stuff on her personal stereo that she kept with her. You know, songs that we listened to because of his strong religious background, yes. But, I don't know, Bob, but what's your take on this, these people who are down, you know, who are being supportive of Mandela, and as soon as they're attacked, they back away from it. What the hell? How can you do that? How can you, you know, hold both sides of the coin up? They hope that enough people don't hear the second part of it.
Well, I mean, we're talking about Gingrich here. Gingrich was just reverting to type.
Yeah.
That was what he wrote over the weekend was a momentary blip of decency.
Yeah.
And those don't happen very often with Newt.
Yeah, that was what amazed me so much.
That was the anomaly, not the business. Because see, he caught that flack because by one, it was understood that by attacking Mandela, one was supporting Reagan. Because remember, Ronnie Reagan, Bill, had Nelson Mandela placed on the international terrorist list.
Yeah. Yeah, I was so far away from so much of that stuff. What years were that? Early 80s. Early to mid 80s.
Well, and it was mid 80ish.
Yeah, I had gotten away. So I had gotten so deep into trying to run a small business, and of course, television has not been a long suit of mine for many, many, many moons. I mean, television is kind of a well. For instance, Saturday Night Live was so big with so many people. But when you were working Saturday nights, you didn't see it. I hardly ever saw it. And it wasn't until later that I caught up with a lot of the great performers and the great things and the great comedic acts that were being played out against the world around us. And I remember reading things. You know, the Dutch had a good thing going for themselves for a while in South Africa. They were trying to convince the rest of the world that they actually landed there when nobody else was there. And some of the folks came down from up north and wanted a piece of the pie, and they didn't want to give it to them because it was something that the Dutch had, the Dutch citizens had just invented by themselves and created by themselves. So they were actually going this far in their bullshit. And you saw it printed, and you heard it. So you didn't, if you didn't know better, you know, if you didn't take the time to go look and find out that they were bullshitting, which I did, of course, and you kind of know it to begin with, Bob. But if you're a history person, you kind of check it out just to see, to make sure that they're lying the way you think they are. And as I say, my thing always comes back to North, to South Africa, is how the hell when they, after the English kicked their butts, the Boer, you know, the Dutchmen got back in control of the country again. I mean, what the hell happened? Do you have any concept of how that happened?
No, I really don't know the history well enough to even touch it.
Cause, you know, that's... Because that was... Well, that was some... I think it was this mother's brother did a mock out of a song from the Boer War. Where Marching to Pretoria was the original line, and when this mother's brother's, I think, did it, it changed to Peoria. And they got a lot of mileage out of that. But yeah, it's the same old. I mean, it's just, how do you keep finding these people, huh? They just keep shoving themselves at you.
Well, they don't go away, and they are, and that's why I was asking the question. I was asking about what Dr. John wrote about messy thinking and gibberish and nonsense.
Yep.
We are really highly, for reasons I don't fully understand. Maybe this is something that a Noam Chomsky or George out there. Why can't I remember? I had it there just for a second. Don't think of an elephant. George Lakoff, sorry, could explain. But there is no one able to openly explain to these people that they are engaging in gibberish thought. Because, and to a certain extent, I guess you can say that it's a function of our polarized social structure at this point in time, that nobody will tell anybody when they're really, really, really getting it wrong. And, you know, I mean, let's say, I mean, there's nobody on the Republican side that is going to tell those Republicans who posted on Gingrich's blog, for instance, nobody's going to come through and say, you know, you really are not communicating intelligently.
Yep.
So I think we can say something about the ability to communicate verbally, but to communicate in written form, generally about this country. And I'm not going to get all curmudgeonly and cranky and stuff and go down that road right now. But you can ask anybody who teaches English 101 at any college in this country how literate this country is, and you will get most likely a very, very, very pessimistic assessment.
Well, they hardly taught us when I was in school, too. They didn't, you know, if you didn't go out on your own and pick up a book here and there and get your attention and go into it a little bit farther, and then you see the other side of the coin, then you go a little deeper to find out more and more. Otherwise, you're lost. And as I say, during that time period when Reagan was elected, I just to kind of stuck my head in the sand and, you know, just, well, how long can I just avoid looking at this guy? Because I had, in the 60s, people going to school in California had sent me newspapers from out there talking about the situation between Reagan and the students at the different colleges in California and, you know, during his gubernatorial term. And so I just never could realize how people could elect this guy to anything. But, you know, what can you do? You can't seem to get anywhere with him. But you keep coming up with this stuff, and it just boggles it after a while for me. The mind just goes, you know.
Let me throw another little something your way, since we often talk about issues musical, Bill. I was sitting around yesterday, when I guess maybe halfway through the day, I realized, oh, damn, this is December the 8th.
Oh, yeah.
And I suddenly, my mind cast back over the years to that Monday night in 1980 when John Lennon was shot four times in the back.
Yep.
Isn't it interesting how the assassins generally like to shoot from behind?
Yeah, good back shooters, yeah.
And I don't know what would have, you know, he had a brand new record out that was about to just really take off.
He was going to do something, yeah.
But there are people in our existence whom we tend to ask, what if? Especially when they are, you know, when they are killed in untimely fashion, or die of disease in an untimely, or even when they live to a fairly advanced age, it's hard to imagine. I mean, it sure would be nice to have Molly Ivins and Hunter S. Thompson around right now.
Yeah.
But I think John Lennon is a giant question mark for a lot of people.
Yeah, I still don't. Well, that guy was. I think the guy that, for once, the guy that nailed for that shooting was the guy that did it.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's no doubt about that.
This guy was out and out whacked.
He was sentenced to 20 to life, and I think he's been turned down for parole at least a half a dozen times.
Yeah, he was pretty strange kid. I mean, I don't care how angry I. Just to go, what did he go halfway around the world to pull that one off?
From Hawaii.
Yeah. Jeez, I mean, Bob, I have the kind of temperament that if I'm armed and somebody starts screwing around with me, you never know. I might have had different points in my life lost it. But I'll be damned if I'm going to go hunting around for anybody. And I just, you know, maybe there's something saner about me than I thought, but I would be damned if I'd be the world to get somebody, you know. That hurts. I mean, it takes just a amount of insanity that I can't deal with, you know. I'm the kind of guy who might wear a funny looking hat with an N on it now and then, but you know, I'm not going to go chasing somebody around. December the 8th is a strange date to me too, because in 1952 I had the pleasure of making my first Holy Communion and my confirmation on the same day. What a thrill. Yeah.
Did it stick?
What?
Did it stick?
No. nah. My first wife and I got married in a congregational church. Well, where else does a young Jewish nurse and a German Catholic get married, you know? Musician get married.
Neutral turf.
Yeah, you find something neutral. And then the second time around, it was some judge, you know, and that was that. And, I was down at the Euclid Tavern when I first learned about that, that he had been shot. And I just couldn't believe it. I said, what the hell kind of, I understand, I shouldn't say this, but I do tend to understand political assassinations and such more, because the very nature of the business can bring out the worst in somebody. But my God, Lennon, I mean, he said a few things that were controversial, but I guess not in my book, you know. They weren't that controversial to me. And a friend of mine's father was a DJ here, was the head of a news department at a station in Cleveland when they bought the Beatles to Cleveland, and my friend's father got a chance to sit and play cards. Told his son with Lennon, and he said Lennon was quite the man to sit and to talk to. He said Lennon was full of memories of the massive, you know, the buzz bombing of Britain, you know. And he talked a lot about growing up in that time period. And I was not, I thought they were tremendously good, but, you know, emotionally their stuff was excellent. But it didn't move me the way blues and soul performers did. It didn't have the same kick in the gas that those guys had. And also, my sister was a big fan of English music hall music. And a lot of what the Beatles did, like in Sgt. Pepper's.
Yeah.
A whole lot of that.
Well, that came from the fact it wasn't Paul's dad a music hall performer at one point?
It was, yeah.
And he always evinced a fondness for that genre. You can hear it in some of the hits. Goodnight Tonight has kind of an homage, you know, with that tinny sounding, not very resonant, low end microphone kind of thing going. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
There was a whole. There was so much English. The movies. Did you ever see the Lavender Hill Mob?
No.
Oh, great movie with Sellers and a few other people. It's based on a theft that they try to pull off. And there was a whole series of slapstick stuff, the Carry On series in the 60s, where it was the same people over and over again. And it was mostly hardcore slapstick stuff. And, it was, and again, that English music hall stuff. And who was the guy on television for so many years, the heavy set guy that did the syndicated show?
Oh, Benny Hill?
Benny Hill. He was another example of that style. But the Beatles, me, I was more of a Stones kind of a guy because of the you know, where they were coming from.
Yeah, they worked the blues end of the street considerably yeah. more.
Yeah. And believe me, if you were around when Barry was doing Barry, and the Beatles did Barry, they did a fine job. But I hate to say it, but I think Barry did it better. You know, to me, emotionally,
yeah.
it hit me harder. But when they started moving into the English entertainment scene, they were really good at bringing in a whole new thing into the, you know, into the music, which was always necessary and this kind of stuff. And, you know, guys like me who get stuck in the background somewhere and keep doing the same thing. But, yeah, I remember that day quite well. And, of course, then I thought about it. It did mean something to me, too, because of the... and their religious background. Can I look back on that and say, that actually happened to you, Bill? And it was kind of strange because the Archbishop came out to perform the services. He's an old dude with a good old Irish tenor, you know? And watching these nuns almost swoon over the old guy, you know, had you laughing a little bit when you're 9, 10 years old, you know? Thinking, that's a little strange, isn't it? They really acted like this guy was a vaudeville singer when the bishop would start to sing Irish music. Hey, he had a good thing going. He knew his hustle, you know. He could work his hustle pretty good, too, because that worked for him. But anyway, I'll clear the line for somebody else. Yeah, I keep saying, where does Bob find these people? Do you go out with a pick and a shovel and... to dig these guys up?
And just start looking under rocks.
Oh, jeez. I mean, it's Rios. Where did she come from?
I think she came from Concerned Women for America, which was, again, you know, these right, they're all, you know, they object to welfare, but these are all welfare people.
Oh, yeah.
And the most nasty kind of welfare, because it's religion industry welfare, where they just perpetually live off of tax-free money.
Yeah, they don't pay tax on that stuff. Yeah.
Well, the organizations that pay them pay no taxes.
Yep.
You know, it's talk about knowing your hustle.
Well, I know a few people that were actually, you know, shall we say, a little on the crooked side, and I talked to him about, hey, you know, what if we start our own religion and we set up a, you know, church? Hey, you can hustle the hell out of it. You know, confidence men are confidence men.
Well, you know what? I've got a good example of that, Bill, from last week, maybe a week and a half ago. Oddly enough, it comes from Texas. And way back when Kansas was trying to force people to acquiesce in having their children in public schools taught that Adam and Eve rode to church every Sunday on a dinosaur, this atheist came up with a completely, utterly, no doubt about it, bullshit religion that he also wanted to insist be taught alongside the creation story from Genesis. And you've heard of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, this guy invented the Flying Spaghetti Monster. And it just started with really simple things, like first the Flying Spaghetti Monster created a mountain and a tree and a dwarf. And it took off from there. The Flying Spaghetti Monster Afterlife is apparently a place where there is where you get a stripper factory and a beer volcano.
I'll take those.
And let's see what are, and at the end of Flying Spaghetti Monster prayers, everyone says ramen.
Ah.
And one hopes to be touched by his noodly appendage.
Oh.
And so somewhere along the way, pirates entered into the dogma. And as an explanation for global warming, that global the planetary temperatures have continued to rise since pirates, traditional patch-wearing, parrot-on-the-shoulder, yar-saying pirates, began disappearing from the scene. So they entered into the dogma. And then finally, it emerged, because this is, you know, this is all in the way of revealed wisdom. You know, the deity never gives you everything at one whack. It has to
unveiling it.
Right, right. So eventually, it became known that truly devout and by this time they had a name, Pastafarians.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah, truly devout Pastafarians have to wear silly headgear like other religions wear.
That's true, yeah.
And the silly headgear that the Pastafarians wear is a spaghetti strainer turned upside down on their heads. A colander.
Yeah.
Sure. Because if we're going to respect the rights of people, of religious people, to wear silly headgear, then we have to respect every religion's right to wear silly headgear. So lo and behold, a guy by the name of Eddie Castillo in Texas went down to the Texas DMV for his license renewal, in which he insisted that he had the right to be photographed wearing a colander on top of his head. And here's the funny thing. He succeeded.
Oh, brother.
Because really, you know, as I've said before, Bill, the First Amendment is nothing but a life support system for the religion industry.
True. Very true.
So the Flying Spaghetti Monster says that Eddie Castillo has to wear silly headgear.
Yeah.
And the First Amendment says that government can't suppress your right to wear silly headgear. So now there's a license photo of him wearing colander on his head.
I wonder what the cops say if they pull him over for an illegal right turn or something, you know?
Well, if he's got the silly headgear on?
Yeah.
Can't say a damn thing to him because that's his religious right in America.
Yeah, I guess, but it's got to, it would have me laughing if I had looked at a license.
Oh, why, yeah, absolutely. Now the real question is, what happens if he's not, if he gets pulled over for making a U-turn or something like that, and he's not wearing the silly headgear in his photo like his God tells him he has to.
Oh, God, yeah. He's, yeah.
But, you know, I'm sure he's a devout Pastafarian and probably does, there's nowhere he goes that he's not taking his religiously mandated silly headgear with him.
I'll tell you, that's got to be good for a laugh and a free beer from so many people that you. Yeah, but before I get off of here, I want to thank a couple of the friends of the that are helping me get my computers the hell out of here this week, and our friend out in Colorado, a young gentleman who has turned me on to a very good radio station. It's amazing, Bob, the stuff I've listened to in the last few days. In fact, this morning, I actually heard a broadcast of a show from 38 that was the story of how the Lone Ranger himself hooked up with the horse Silver. It was amazing that people could sit down and write this kind of stuff. But it was first broadcast 5 years before I was born, and God knows I'm old enough as it is. And I said, oh my geez. It's been so good to hear some of those shows again and just sit there and laugh.
Travel with us now to those daring days of yesteryear.
Oh, God. And so many of the comedians and such that it's funny, some of the radio things that were, like, like Inner Sanctum and such. Some of them can get pretty weird because it was all based on words. You know, there was no pictures to go with it.
Right. The weird happened between your ears, which remains the beauty of radio.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. It was just I sometimes think that this is why my generation and the ones around the same time, we developed one hell of an imagination. Because you had to, and between that and reading, that kind of imagination is what used this kind of stuff for thinking processes. We really thought about things a little bit. I mean, when you sit down and think about Mandela and about South Africa, and you start thinking that how the hell this small bunch of people was able to take control like that. Well, they were brutal, that's why. They would do whatever it took to keep control. And that's what scares me about the future for you guys who are younger than me. Because I'm not going to have to put up with it for too long compared with you folks and your son, for crying out loud. You know, it's a dog that this stuff is. It just angers me no end, Bob. Just sends me to the. I guess I would have been a good Civil War era guy, you know, going to get my blue uniform and my Springfield to go put an end to this crap.
What, no butternut?
Nah. Well, if I lived down there, maybe. Because you're a product of your environment.
Yeah, but that's not entirely true. The 4th Alabama Cavalry was raised and did a hell of a job.
Yep.
Fighting against the traitors.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of activity in the swamps of the Mississippi Delta toward the end of the war. There was a lot of fellas that were.
Well, these folks ran across North Alabama and into Tennessee and Georgia.
Well, and East Tennessee had difficulties, too, because it was a small area with a lot of small farms. And you know what small farms did not require? That
Yeah, slaves.
Exactly.
And that East Tennessee area had also, of course, been the origins of the Free State, the Washington Association, I think it was called, which was a precursor to the independence movement before the Revolution. And so they had a long history of free-spiritedness. And, in fact, East Tennessee was a bastion of anti-Confederate sentiment.
Well, I've heard stuff about the Free State of Franklin. Have you ever heard that?
Yeah,
there's a band up here that uses that name. And they're very good at what they do.
This was the Washington Association, I think. The Watauga. Yeah, the Watauga Association, maybe. These are the same people who marched across and kicked British ass at King's Mountain.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, the guys the Britons made shit of and,
they liquored up, marched across the hills and fought a little bit and went back home.
Well,
and therein saved the entirety of the American Revolution.
Yep. There were the guys that were really. I say that book that what's his name wrote, the former Democratic senator.
Oh yeah, Jim Webb.
Yeah, that Born Fighting. It opened my eyes to it. Well, I knew the Scotsmen were always a little belligerent over Scotland itself. You know, being.
Oh, we'll get belligerent over lunch.
Yeah, I guess that's. Remind me not to pick a fight with any of these guys.
Hey, Bill, you have yourself a good evening.
And before I say, I want to thank the fellas and my buddy out in Colorado. He knows what I'm talking about. We've got to be pretty good BSers together.
Excellent. Wonderful.
Anyway, you hang in there.
All right. You keep us posted. Take care, Bill. Bye now. Our buddy Bill calling from Cleveland, Mr. Stress. And onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, how are you tonight?
I'm dandy, Jim. How are you?
No, pretty good. Rufus went to a Christmas party next door.
Really?
Yeah.
Invited or?
Yeah, this lady has cats over there, so she wanted to have a cat party. And he walks on a leash, so I just years ago my mother sent me this type of fake lion's mane to put around her neck. So I found it, and I put it on him and put the leash on his collar, and she walked him right on over. So so they're going to have a cat party.
How nice. The shady lady didn't get the invite?
Mm-mm, she's too old.
An
old lady now. She's asleep. She's going on 14. So she doesn't party too much anymore. Nope, not at all. But I thought that was just kind of unusual, but nonetheless, if anybody else, I told this story to anybody else, they'd think I was crazy, and, you know, but, you know, yeah, he walks on a leash, just like a dog.
Well, that's because he's a gentleman, right?
He is a real gentleman. He certainly is. Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, that's the latest thing here. Have you got your tree up?
About half. We've gotten the tree itself up, the artificial, but have yet to festoon it.
Well, you know, I used to put up trees and stuff like that. I had a fiber optic tree and all that stuff. But I mean, you know, by the time you get that thing sprung out and all the decorations put on it, and then there's all this big build up to Christmas, and then boom, it's gone. Then you have all that stuff to deal with again. So now I have it's on my coffee table. It's about 2 feet, well, about 2.5 feet tall. It's like a ceramic tree, except it rotates. And if you, it has lights and everything on it. And if you click a switch on it, it'll play Christmas Carol.
Oh.
So, I mean, you know, that's just a quick, easy way to put it back in the box, put it in the kitchen, and, you know, or not the kitchen, but put it back in the closet. And that's that. Plus, I have all these lit houses, Department 56 houses that I keep year up around. So it's sort of Christmas here year round, you know? And they're kind of pretty to look at.
In the dim and dark of winter, there's a reason for all the lights. I mean, this weekend the weather was so poor around here, Jim. It seemed like dark got here about noon.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be beyond a doubt, it can be kind of stressful and depressing.
Well, you know, seasonal affective disorder.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's dark, and so you have lights to try to alleviate that. And it's good for the mood and good for anything else that's going to trouble you to make you depressed because of bad weather. And
I have long thought that we need to keep it up through the end of, keep the lights out and through the end of February.
Well, yeah.
Because, December can get pretty grim, but you got folks in the, well, at least some, there are a lot of people out there who aren't in the holiday spirit for a variety of reasons.
Oh, yeah.
One of which being that they don't share, you know, Christmas. But, of course, I take a sort of ecumenical view to it because I recognize that Christmas was not the beginning of all of this. That people have been celebrating the turn away from the darkness and toward the light that occurs at the solstice from just about as soon as we figured out the nature of those planetary movements. And oddly enough, that's something that human beings figure out relatively quickly.
Yeah, pretty much so.
But February is just... February is hateful, Jim.
Well, yeah, it is. But nonetheless, that's just the way things are. So you basically think about Valentine's Day and this, that, and the other different holidays that are punctuated throughout the year to lift your spirits or whatever.
I much prefer the Roman calendar that began with the month of March, which of course was named for the war god Mars, because it meant that the weather had changed enough that the Romans could go back to war.
Yeah, they were pretty good at that. That was one of their that and also engineering, because if they weren't fighting, they were building.
That and basically in March you can get your crops into the ground and then march away. And hope that the crops will be good till you get back in when the campaigning season is over.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's basically, I guess, the way they establish their yearly schedule. Nonetheless, there it is.
And January was named after the god of two faces because I guess in Italy, January can go either way.
Right. Absolutely. And January can be strange, particularly in the south. It can be real strange. And then, of course, I've seen snow in South Carolina in May. So, I mean, you know, here it is.
And, of course, here, too.
Yeah, well, right, absolutely. But going on about South Africa, that was an interesting situation between the British and the Boers and things of that nature. Churchill wrote extensively of it and his memoirs. That's one of the ways that he got established, I think, as a writer, was his adventures against the Afrikaans or the...
Yeah, the two things that established him early on as a young man and a proto-journalist were the Boer War and with Kitchener in the Sudan.
Yeah. And the thing about in South Africa, now they had these, when the British came in there, and I'm not sure if it even started with them, but they had these reservations called Bantustans,
mm-hmm.
in which they kept people corralled up. And they had a number of oppressive measures in place to keep the natives in line. Of course, they did that because they had superior technology. They had rifles and they had Gatling guns and cannons and things of that nature. And, you know, they were fairly able to establish themselves as the ruling element there. And, of course, you had commercial interests, too, still exist to this day. I'm very sure that De Beers is still in business with their diamond mining. And
oh, quite. And the gold business, I'm told, is quite lucrative.
Oh, yeah, very much so. So it's a definitely a economically rich area. I mean, the whole of Africa is. But, you know, but it was pretty oppressive during the regime of apartheid with separate park benches and things of that nature. And my point is, number one, you had the concentration camps, which were basically the Bantustans. And, of course, you know, the separate park benches and strict segregation and this, that, and the other. And oddly enough, you had Adolf Hitler applying the same type of things to Jews.
That was the next thing I was going to mention. It's not like the Third Reich just invented this stuff. There was a long history of things that they had learned.
And as a matter of fact, he also was very much of a devotee of American history in his own right. As a matter of fact, he even had a museum. One of his favorite authors was a guy named Carl May, who wrote Wild West stories. And they even had somewhere in Berlin this Wild West thing in which Indians and a bar and everything set up. So Carl May was one of his favorite authors when he was a young man. And he often, too, referred to our practices with the American Indians. And he used that as a model with the reservation system.
And don't forget Jackson's forced removal.
Of course, the deportation of the Trail of Tears. So he had definitely things. As a matter of fact, he even referred to that in one of his last speeches before the war started in April of 23rd of 1939, when Roosevelt had asked him, you know, do you intend to attack Poland? And of course, Hitler was at the height of his oratory powers, and he went on to slyly mention every name in the entire country. And I think Poland may have been omitted. I think it was, according to William L. Shirer. And he also said to Mr. Roosevelt, he said, you know, you are accusing me of warlike tendencies and things of that nature and settling everything by peace. And he said, well, did you settle your disputes in the American Civil War by peaceful means? No. And then, did you settle your disputes with the American Native Indians by peaceful means and the subjugation of the Sioux Indian tribes? I mean, this is right in the dialogue of his speech to the Reichstag, and they were all just laughing. I mean, he would basically ask questions and then say, "Antwort, answer." And that was one of the greatest speeches he ever made, the last one he ever made as an orator. From that point forward, he would try to make his way in history as a warrior. But to read that speech and to listen to the things that he said, that you could draw analogies to things precedents in history, he had a lot of things to go on.
Well, the fact of the matter is the failure of the United States, Jim, to deal humanely with problems arising out of the rights of others has forever been something that has dogged us. Through the Cold War, it dogged us. The Soviets were constantly berating the United States over civil rights. The Chinese to this day, if we, for instance, I remember when we lodged, when somebody said something about Tibet, and I think the Chinese responded by saying, yes, right, and you did such a good job, with the American Indians.
Sure did. Absolutely. Even in that movie about Mel Brooks Blazing Saddles, when the, when the guy says, Mr. Taggart says, Doc, that the guy's passed out, this Chinese guy with the coolie hat passes out, and he says, Doc, that chink a day's wages for sleeping on the job.
Yeah, when he's just, dropped dead.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, it's,
that has always, the United States has a real taste for the moral high ground. And we always seem to slip and slide trying to get up there because its slopes are bloodied with our own horrible, horrible mistakes.
Yeah, they were. I mean, for example, our treatment of the American Indian as far as I'm concerned, the Native Americans were probably, I would say, first they were used by other colonists like the French in the French and Indian War and stuff like that. But then eventually, when Indians were given blankets that were infected with smallpox and things of that nature, and they were just almost decimated by stuff like
that. The fact is, North America was as densely populated as was Mesoamerica, as was South America. In 1491, there are to this day far larger bands of native peoples in Mexico than there are in the United States.
Well, I'm not.
The Spanish were not, even though the Spanish wiped out something on the order of 15 million human beings, they were not as effective at it as were the English and the French and the Dutch.
Well, the Spanish basically, had a system of, there were three systems. First, in New Spain, you had the encomienda, the encomendero. He was the guy who had the big farm. And then, of course, in the French, they had the seigneurial system in which they had large estates. And then in the Dutch had the seigneurial system in which the patron was the head of the big thing. But in New Spain, it would appear to me, on the outskirts of New Spain, they have what was called the Cabildo Abierto. And that, of course, would be in areas that were beyond Veracruz, Mexico City, and stuff like that, in which, there was greater assimilation and more democracy because these little outlying provinces couldn't rely upon the central government for anything. But they had to deal with their own problems themselves, and so this Cabildo Abierto, the open meeting, in which there was a degree of democracy, and of course in North America, I think that was somewhat severely attenuated. I mean, when you had the frontier areas and things of that nature that were beyond the control of the central government or whatever government was in power at that time, or whether it was from London or whether it was from Paris or wherever in the Netherlands.
And the Spanish never even fully reached. I mean, there are areas that have of Mexico and Central America that are largely untouched. One people comes to mind, Jim, from our buddy Jeff Biggers, who wrote a book several years back called In the Sierra Madre. Which he wrote about living among the Rarimuri people, who exist to this day and still speak their own language. I mean, there many, many of the pre-Columbian languages are still extant.
Mm-hmm.
There are like 1 million speakers of Nahuatl. There are speakers of Lauchi, speakers of the Rarimuri language. And what is fascinating is that, Americans, people in the United States, see, that word of Americans got slippery too. But people in the United States are so painfully ignorant about just about everything that's that goes on south of the Rio Grande, to the extent that they have no real, they just look at Mexico and they think banana republic. But it's not necessarily so.
No, it's not.
There are, for instance, there are online radio stations that broadcast in those native languages, because there are still a lot of people who speak more of that than they do of Spanish. In fact, from a religious standpoint, to give you an idea of how successful or unsuccessful some missionaries were, I think it's the Rarámuri people who were kinda converted, but not particularly. So they put on their Easter festival every year, if I recall correctly, and in their Easter pageant, guess who the hero is? Judas.
Well, somebody had to do it, I guess.
Well, right. The person without whom the passion doesn't happen.
Right. I mean, somebody had to go into the Sanhedrin and be paid.
And, of course, the rise of the cult of the Blessed Virgin of Guadalupe comes, I think, straight out of Nahual myth. Mexica, Tezcalteca, Acolhua, Tecpaneca myth.
As a matter of fact, my rosary is contained within a box that has her picture, the Virgin of Guadalupe. But the Spanish, they had, or the Native American, it's just amazing what they did with Christianity and stuff like that, and how they incorporated it into their own religious practices. Of course, you know, that extends throughout the entire Caribbean. I mean, I'm sure you've heard of Santeria.
Sure.
And that's an interesting situation in which they have developed their own gods that were brought from Africa into those areas, in which they mix it in with Roman Catholicism and voodoo.
And such has largely been the case. You know, Irish Roman Catholicism is, or was once upon a time at least, considerably different from the Roman Catholicism of, you know, Rome, because there was a totally different mindset that attached to it. And the same applies to the Roman Catholicism of Mesoamerica, South America, and even the Roman Catholicism that is burgeoning now in Africa. You know, that's why Lottie has from time to time made the remark, and I think correctly so, that many recent converts practice with a rosary in one hand and a dead chicken in the other.
Yeah, that is interesting how they can do that and how they have done it.
But it's also a function of how it has been from the very origins. The subsumation of Apollo behind the rising cult, the rising Jesus cult. And how it spreads up out of the Levant across what was then Greek Asia Minor, across the Hellespont, into Corinth, into Rome, and eventually northward from there.
Well, I mean, there is a connection between the Egyptian religions and certain elements of Christianity. For example, Osiris, Isis, and of course Osiris was, of course, you know, murdered by his brother Seth. And, of course, Isis went back and collected all his parts. And then, of course, they had a son named Horus. So there was a holy family. A holy family, so to speak. Yeah. It's interesting. And I think the church basically has a little difficulty in acknowledging some of that stuff. But, of course, they have to. There's no question about it.
That goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, Jim, this particular season. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, it gets darker and darker and darker during these particular days until the winter solstice. And, of course, the Romans celebrated Saturnalia, you know, the rebirth of Saturn, the sun god.
Right.
With the solstice.
Who was that emperor who was so devoted to Sol Invictus? Was it Death?
Oh no, that was the patron god of Constantine's daddy.
But I mean, wasn't Decius or somebody like that who worshipped Sol Invictus, the god of war?
No, Sol Invictus was the unconquerable sun.
But I mean, wasn't Decius the emperor who promoted that particular thing? I mean, there were so many cults in Rome. I mean, you had the cult of Isis. You had so many other cults related.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it was Decius or not. But I know that it came to its full flowering under Constantine's daddy, who died of leukemia. And by this time, of course, the empire had been split in two.
Yeah, east and west.
And Constantine was about to get left out in the cold after his daddy died. And under the banner of Sol Invictus, he was declared Augustus, I think it was, either by the British or by the French, and then proceeded to march toward Rome, where, you know, there on the night before the Battle of the Mulvian Bridge, he had the vision with the cross and the in-hook signo wing case.
Against Bactium, yes.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I remember that. But under this sign, you will conquer. It was basically one of the symbols of the church. But
yeah, some of the first Latin I ever learned came off of a cigarette pack, because in hoc signo wing case was the motto printed on a package of Pall Malls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember seeing that too. Good Lord in heaven. Well, anyway, it's amazing how things evolve, devolve, and, you know, things are developing, and they will continue to develop. And final thing I would just like to see if you know anything about is, I wonder what the Senate is going to do with this unemployment bill. To send unemployment.
Well, it's a bicameral body. It really doesn't matter, does it, Jim?
I don't know. I mean, that's the big thing right now. They have until Friday, I think, to really decide what they're going to do with it.
But the House has to do. The House hasn't done anything.
Well, they're going to have to do something.
The Senate, I think, would easily pass an extension. The House, on the other hand, wouldn't pass a peach pit.
Well, right now, I think the Senate is we're debating on concealed permits for weapons or concealed weapons extension or something like that. I was looking on C-SPAN today to see what they're going to do, because don't they go on leave Friday?
I believe, yes.
My God, they just got back off Thanksgiving leave for 2 weeks.
And I don't, there's not even a post-Christmas session, I don't think.
Uh-uh.
And then they're back the second week of January. So I think a whole lot of unemployed people are going to be told to, you know, suck it.
Well, I certainly hope not, because, I mean, the unemployment benefits officially will end on 1 January.
Right, but we're talking about, and, you know, I go back to my thesis that I've talked about during the shutdown. We're not talking about two political parties with differing philosophies about how American government, American self-government should work. We're talking about one group who is interested in making government work, and we're talking about another side, which is actually an open and active insurgency against the very idea of government. So there's nothing that's going to make John Boehner or Eric Cantor or any of those other freaks take action in the House. I mean, for God's sakes, John Boehner's staff locked their door against children who were singing.
Oh, well, maybe he had a hangover and didn't want to hear any loud noises. I don't know. But from what I hear, compared to some of the rest of them up there, that Boehner is easier to get along with than a lot of his colleagues.
He is,
really?
Because
I mean he's almost caught through the devil in Deep Blue Sea.
You ever been around a neutered dog? They're easier to get along with too. A neutered horse, a gelded horse, is easier to get along with. And the fact of the matter is, the Tea Party has effectively unmanned, if you will, John Boehner.
They have to extent geld at him.
The Senate passed an immigration bill. Nothing's going to happen on the House side. The The only time the House even acted, look how long it took them to act during the shutdown.
I don't know.
So to think that the Republican Party gives a tinker's damn, whether it be Christmas time or High July, about people whose unemployment benefits are running out in a country in which the new normal is 7% plus unemployment, I think that's a little unrealistic, Jim.
It's just crazy because people who receive those benefits, of course, put money into the economy. And they don't keep it. They certainly aren't able to put it into a savings account in most cases. I mean, they actually, you know, pump blood into the economy, and they're really cutting off their noses to ruin their looks or to spite their faces, the old thing would go. And that's, in my opinion, being very terribly short-sighted, number one, from an economic standpoint, and number two, from a humane standpoint.
But Jim, it's only short, and I'm not disagreeing to be disagreeable. I'm not necessarily even disagreeing. It is only short-sighted if you make the essential, if you premise essentially that the Republicans are trying to participate in government. I simply don't believe that anymore. I believe they are an open and active insurgency, traitorous and treasonous in nature, trying to destroy the very ability of this country to govern itself.
Well, you know, it's very difficult when you try to deal with some of these people. I have someone whom I've talked to, and and when you try to, for example, illustrate, just going back to the wars in Iraq and the wars in Afghanistan and this, that, and the other. Any effort to try to make them realize exactly what George W. Bush did, and my last comments to this individual last night were, I said, if I had my way, Cheney and Bush and Rice and a number of other people would be in The Hague being tried for, war crimes. And that just did not set well at all. And, of course, the big thing that they countered with, well, what about Obama? And, you know, they were going on about the Health Care Act and all this kind of stuff. And finally, just being exasperated and not wanting to even talk to the person anymore because my ears started hurting immediately. But I just said, look, I said, I think your real problem is this. But I want you to sit down and think about this. You just don't like black people, and you just can't stand the fact that there's a black man in the White House. And I said, it will be a while before we speak again.
And sometimes you get to that point.
You do. I mean, because these assholes, that's exactly what they are. They're stupid. They're illiterate assholes. They suck on Fox News. And, you know, by a big tit of Fox News and stuff like that. And some of the stuff they come out with on that particular network, particularly, is just, where in the world are they getting this information? And why are they doing this? I just don't understand it. And these people just are like postulants before the host every time they turn on that TV and listen to some of these people on there.
Speaking of which, I read a story today via Chris Hayes's Twitter feed, that a former right-hand man to Roger Ailes at Fox has just been paid off for his silence to the tune of $8 million.
That's nice money if you can get it.
Yeah, but I mean, he was Ailes's right-hand man and was said to know about his business practices.
I see.
I'm sorry, Jim, but $8 million. $8 million is the classic dead girl or live boy kind of money, isn't it?
Well, you know, a little hush money can do a lot of talking, Bob. That's as Mae West once said.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure. And so, you know, $8 million can do a lot to silence a person about anything they might know. It could be embarrassing. I mean, what's $8 billion for these people? That's chump change, really.
Yeah, it is. They lose that turn, shifting their seat on the sofa.
I mean, to them, that's just the cost of doing business. And
that's exactly how the accountants will write it up, Jim.
Exactly. Well, look, you know, it's been nice. I hope you get your Christmas tree all festooned and everything, and I'm going to be waiting to hear a knock at my door because I want my beastie back, and so you take care.
Well, I hope he walks home as well on a leash with a stranger as he walked over with you, Jim.
Oh, he does. He does. He does. I mean, he's extremely tractable. I mean, like I say, you call him a mountain lion or whatever, but he's really not. He's just a big boy.
Just
got long legs, and he's just incredibly intelligent cat too.
It's rather cold around here. So last night, my not at all too terribly intelligent blonde Siamese cat decided she had had enough and jumped up on the bed and curled up in the didn't move till morning.
Well, you know, thing about the difference between dogs and cats. Dogs need a family. A cat needs a staff.
Ain't that the truth?
So, in his particular case, he likes to say he's more like a dog than he is a cat. He really is. And extremely tractable and lovable and a memory like an elephant because he remembers people who have been kind to him and people whom he does not know. And particularly when someone who has been kind to him and has helped me with him with the vet and stuff like that. I mean, he comes up to them wagging his tail just like a dog would. It's just an incredible thing. That cat has an incredible mind. He really does.
If they ever grow thumbs, we're screwed.
Well, I can tell you this. I can remember when I first took him in. And God, Bob, that was just a horrible situation. And he was so abused, and I had placed this cat condo out on the porch with a heating pad in it, and he slept out there in the cold of winter for 3 months before I could get him, and he was going into distemper before he let me take him. And after that, when he came back and he was getting better, he realized what had happened and began to lose his fear of people. Because, like I say, he's part wildcat.
Ah.
He's part wildcat. There's definitely, you can look at his face and everything, the whole bone structure and everything. But there are people who want to listen to you say other things than me talk about my cat. So I will wish you all beginning Merry Christmas, and I hope you have a good holiday and everything. Let me be the first to wish you that, and may the weather be kinder to all of us, and I will get off here, and good night to you, sir.
You take care, Jim. Good all talking right. to you. Bye now. And, yeah, 18 minutes past the hour. If you want to jump into the conversation, you are more than welcome. This is something I brought up talking to Bill. It was a Monday night, and I was a little pimply-faced DJ. And in my case, the teletype, and it was still a teletype. It wasn't that one of those highfalutin new dot matrix printers back then. This thing weighed about 5 million pounds, was made of what seemed to be solid cast iron, and had a giant and really noisy typewriter inside it. And changing the ribbon on it was something that I'd bring out the Bartleby, the Scrivener, and yeah, I'd rather not. I prefer not to. But yeah, this is a little moment from Monday Night Football, December the 8th, 1980.
But it's suddenly been placed in total perspective for us. I'll finish this. They're in the hurry-up offense.
Third down, 4. Foreman. It'll be fourth down. Kavanaugh will let it run down for one final attempt. He'll let the seconds tick off to give Miami no opportunity whatsoever. Timeout is called. 3 seconds remaining. John Smith is on the line. And I don't care what's on the line, Howard. You have got to say what we know in the booth.
Yes, we have to say it. Remember, this is just a football game. No matter who wins or loses. An unspeakable tragedy confirmed to us by ABC News in New York City. John Lennon, outside of his apartment building on the west side of New York City, the most famous perhaps of all of the Beatles, shot twice in the back, rushed to Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival. Hard to go back to the game after that news flash, which in duty bound we had to take. Frank?
Indeed it is. 3 seconds remain. John Smith.
Up the hands of Rose, the tight end. Alertly, Matt Moore got the touchdown. They blocked the field goal attempt of John Smith. Now they battle it overtime. Delvin Williams. Delvin Williams.
Taken quickly there. It was number 85,
Julius Adams.
Right. Gain of a yard. It'll be 3rd and 7.
In case the folks missed the earlier news flash, ABC News has confirmed that John Lennon, a member of the famed Beatles, maybe the best known member, was shot twice in the back outside of his apartment building in the west side of New York tonight, rushed to the Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival. An unspeakable tragedy. Details on Nightline 30 minutes after the end of this contest.
You get the idea that Cosell's favorite Beatle was John? It's... strange. That. Let's see. So he was 40 years old. So he would now be 73. And I guess the weird sidebar story is that I was I announced the news too. Of course, we were in the Central Time Zone, an hour behind, and I was working at the Gospel Voice. And read out the news and was told the next day that I had very nearly lost my job for announcing the news of the murder of John Lennon. And that I was never to so much as, again, speak his name. Because he was a servant of Satan. Wait a minute. Satan! No, really. Marty noting, gee, imagine how Al Michaels would have spoken of the death of John Lennon if he spoke of it at all. And, you know, America had a love, for those of you who don't recall, America had a love-hate relationship with Howard Cosell. But we will not see his like again. Sports broadcasters are duller than dishwater unless they're just annoying the life out of you. In a way, I was kind of sad that Ohio State choked on the Big Ten championship, because had the national championship game been between Florida State and Ohio State, I would not have been able to possibly even remotely by so much as a goddamn molecule care less. Instead, it's Auburn in the midst of what can only be described as a charmed season. And so I will probably watch the national championship, which means I'll have to listen to Brent Musburger. Oh, yuck. Who last year... oh, please, please don't go to the game. A.J. McCarron's girlfriend, maybe you're married now. Please don't go to the game. Please don't go to the game in Pasadena. Please. Because last year, Brent Musburger was all dirty old man in the back of the movie theater in a raincoat She's pretty. Oh, they grow them pretty. Oh, it was revolting. Dr. John says, Cosell was a John Lennon guy. Vern Lundquist? Ringo. Marty asking, with regard to the fundies, and Imagine pissed them off that much, eh? Oh, it wasn't just Imagine. It probably wasn't even primarily Imagine. It was the early statement in the heyday of Beatlemania, in which it was John, was it not, who said, the Beatles have become more popular than Jesus? Or some such. And it wasn't an attack on Christianity, but all over the South and all over the Southwest, people lost their freaking minds. At that point in time, the Beatles were more popular than Jesus. And John was not one much for self-censorship. And so we'll take a little break as we move down toward the last 30 minutes of the program. We have stalled. We have stalled in Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. We have stalled at $110. So any help we can get toward fulfilling Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge and thereby doubling your money and helping to keep the horn out of a hole is badly needed in the next 33 minutes or so. That's 11 folks at $10 a piece. Hopefully we can do that. Hopefully. So, yeah, it's a year and a day later, but it's a Monday night, and it was, how about that? It was a Monday night 33 years ago. It's easy when talking about John Lennon to play something like Imagine. That's kind of the pop equivalent of what happens every January when the only thing we ever remember about Dr. King was the I Have a Dream speech and the content of his character line. I had a brief exchange on Twitter with my buddy the Angry Indian. You've heard him on the program a couple of times. And he was talking about the whitewashing of the legacy of Nelson Mandela. And I simply said that wasn't whitewashing, that was Santa Clausization. In another 1,000 years or so, good little girls and boys will be rewarded at some time of the year by a visit from Nelson and Martin, who will give them presents if they've been good little girls and boys. And they'll be attended by an elf named Gandhi, who will give bad little girls and boys sea salt. Because that's the way that myths work. And myths are often, you know, the point of myth is that it has, any given myth is going to have its problems, which are then going to call for more myths to explain the problems. Hence, what I was saying in my conversation with Jim about the elevation of Judas to hero status in the Easter myth. And Dr. John picked up on that right quick, and he said, Judas has always been a problem. Without him, no passion. Hard to totally demean him in that light. And what's really interesting is if you go to the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and you read the Judas story, Judas gets progressively worse until he is practically the devil incarnate in the book of John, which, of course, is the furthest removed from the actual execution of a brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and semi-literate itinerant rabbi named Yeshua Bar Yusuf. Myth is fascinating. Oh, thanks very much. Thanks very much to Henry. We are now at $95 to meet Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. Thank you very much. Like I said, I think this can be done. I think we can get there. But to go back, like I said, it's easy to say Imagine, because it feels like a philosophical statement. But there is ever so much more in John Lennon's body of work. Whatever gets you through the night. Instant Karma. Or This Time of Year, Happy Christmas, War is Over. But the one I think probably set a lot of people on edge, you know, the Richard Nixons of the world and so forth, I don't know this for a fact, but the one that I think set a lot of people on edge is probably this one.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion, sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. Want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
Yeah, you can kind of hear that getting under the skin of the oligarchs and the one percenters. And of course, there are always those, well, he was an effing millionaire, man. It's real easy to say a working class hero is something to be when you're an effing millionaire. I don't buy that quite so easily. Not that I'm sitting here arguing with myself, but I've heard it said. Who was it? Russell Brand. Russell Brand got himself in a bit of a bind lately by talking about the fact that he feels like this is a rigged game politically speaking. And he wasn't just talking about the UK. And he said, I don't know why we bother to vote at all. Why don't we just quit? Or something like that. And people just jumped up in his face. And, of course, the typical argument made was, well, yeah, I mean, you know, but, like, you're rich. Okay. And he responded by saying, gee, when I was poor, nobody was interested in anything I had to say. And now that I've made money, they still want me to stay shut up. I didn't necessarily agree with the totality of what Russell Brand said, but you know, for God's sakes, at least he was talking about class and privilege and wealth. The John Lennon tune, Working Class Hero. Let's see here. Just for the fun of it. Just within the very narrow confines of the music collection here. Let me see what I can get here. Okay, so we're just going to the music. We're going to look up the word class. Well, okay. Bill Gates has decided that maybe I meant to write classical. No, I didn't. No, that doesn't mention class. No, that's more classical. No, Bing Crosby. No. Just looking for a song with the word class in the title. Nope. 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 Uh-uh. No. No. Nope, nope, nope. Judas Priest, Stained Class. Okay. That's two songs that mention the word class in the title. Nope. No. And I mean, it's not a huge collection, but there's a good bit of stuff here. No, not Pan Classique in B minor. No. No, not Etude for Piano in C sharp. Sorry. No. Two songs. Judas Priest and John Lennon. I have no idea what Stained Class sounds like, and quite honestly, I don't know what that's doing in my collection, but what the hell, why not? Oh, all right, I admit it. I had my Judas Priest sort of days, but, yeah. But, yeah. But above all, isn't the idea of raising the issue of class one of the great anathema topics of this country? Because, you know, we're supposed to be classless, right? Everybody gets a fair shake. And you know what? I got proof that everybody gets a fair shake. Oh, yes, I do. Oh, by the way, thank you very much, Gene. Thank you, Gene. We are now at $75. We are fully halfway toward meeting Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge in the next 21 minutes or so. Seven people. $10, one person at $5. 14 people, 15 people at $5, however you prefer. So thank you very much, one and all, who have helped meet Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge for the evening. I get a note saying how much pleasure Shirley gets out of her challenge being well received. Now, everybody's got a fighting chance in the United States, right? That's why everybody needs to know the rules. I think it was late last week when Dr. John dropped a note of appreciation for all the people with no union protection whatsoever who nonetheless staged job actions against fast food outfits, more than 100 of them across the country. in a desperate bid to make their corporate employers understand the straits in which they were living. Enter McDonald's. Wow, if I never had a good enough reason to not so much as set foot in that place, I've got it now. CNBC broke the story. Apparently, there is a part of the McDonald's website for McDonald's workers. We're going to have to go through this kind of slowly because it was tough for me to get my noggin around. If you're an employee of the clown, you can go to the website and be taught how to get by in the world, among other things. One fast food worker was told that they needed to sign up for food stamps. Some other workers were told that they could make their food budgets go further by cutting their food into smaller pieces. This is the clown. But this one, exposed by CNBC, which is kind of a surprise because they run a little fascist over there, don't they? For the sake of its employees and the edification of them, the clown's corporate management had posted on their website some etiquette help for your average employee of the clown. And in terms of that etiquette, they wanted employees of McDonald's to know tipping guides. Let's say you work, I'm not kidding, let's say you work at McDonald's, and I know that we have people in the Horn family who do. Let's say you work at McDonald's and you have an au pair back home taking care of your little bundle of joy while you're there at work. Well, McDonald's posted on its website that if you've got an au pair at home, an appropriate gift tip during the holiday season is for you to give from your family, plus a small gift from your child who is being looked after by the au pair, 1 week's pay to your au pair, your nanny there, taking care of your child while you're working at McDonald's. Meanwhile, a McDonald's worker should also give 1 day's pay to their housekeeper. I am not joking. This did not come from The Onion or The Daily Current or any of that. Also, the McDonald's worker should be prepared to tip the cost of one cleaning to their pool cleaner. Their pool cleaner. It could probably get up CNBC notes somewhere around $1,000 of tipping for McDonald's workers. A week's pay for the au pair, a day's pay for the housekeeper, and the cost of one pool cleaning for the pool cleaner. I don't know what you give the cabana boy. Rather than, and see, this is the beauty of corporate PR, rather than admit, holy shit, did we really put that, find who, get, well, no, they did do that part. because they pulled it down quickly, thinking that the internet simply forgets things. It didn't. So when the McDonald's PR department figured out that, no, it had not gone down the internet memory hole and was going to be, well, no, it's not there anymore. It was, no, we didn't. You can't prove it. Doesn't work. Still, rather than saying, wow, that was a really boneheaded, stupid thing for us to do, the McDonald's PR machine kicked into high indignation mode and explained upon inquiry Asa asking, Bob, are we sure these guides were not geared toward their executives? No! No, 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 no. No, they went into high public relations indignity mode and said, and trotted out Lisa McComb, who said, "This is content. This is beautiful. This is from a personal responsibility American corporation. Remember, corporate America wants to remind you to always take personal responsibility for your actions. We're not going to take it for ours, but then again, we're not you." They hauled out Lisa McComb, who said, "This is content provided by a third-party partner and quotes from one of the best-known etiquette gurus." We talked about this, Lisa. "Emily Post. We continue to review the resource and will ask the vendor to make changes as needed." It's 2013. Emily Post is still the etiquette guru? I strongly suggest that they also post Mark Twain's "How I Edited an Agricultural Paper." Because, you know, most of the folks working at McDonald's need a second job. Don't you love that? "This is content provided by a third-party partner." Really? They're not a third-party vendor? Oh, no. They only become a vendor a little further into the paragraph. They're a partner. They're not an associate. They're a partner. Wouldn't it, just out here being a prole in the hinterland, wouldn't it be delightful just once to find a story like this and find that the PR flack walked out front and said, "God damn, that was stupid. And we're going to try not to be stupid anymore. We're going to start off with our non-stupidity by stopping resisting raising the minimum wage." And that's the odd thing. McDonald's has actually usually been out front on the wage issue. In years past, McDonald's has wholeheartedly supported an increase in the minimum wage because they were paying higher than minimum wage in the first place. And so they wanted to see the king and the little red-haired pigtail girl and catch up to them because it leveled the playing field for the corporation. But they're not at $15 an hour. And just to reinforce, if they were at $15 an hour, it is highly likely that a McDonald's employee could still not afford to give a day's wage to the housekeeper or be able even to afford a housekeeper. It is still unlikely that a McDonald's employee could afford to give the cost of one pool cleaning to the pool cleaner because they don't have a pool. Or give a week's pay to the au pair.
The au pair.
Whatever happened to giving out booklets of McDonald's 50-cent gift coupons? 50 cents. I think that thing cost $5 back when I was a kid. That damn thing probably costs 50 now. See, people, these campaigners are trying to be really nice, actually, about how they're approaching the issue. They're not putting bricks through windows. They're not torching Wendy's store number 10,506. They're asking very politely and nicely of power, if power will please just treat them like human beings. Sadly, history is not replete with a number of examples of times when asking things nicely of power have resulted in power giving of itself. Tim tells me that McDonald's is putting books about healthy living in 20 million Happy Meals. The promotion will last 2 weeks. Tim says the same corporation is teaching 20 million people how to eat correctly. I mean, what does the first thing say? Stay the hell out of here? And this is the same corporation that was slapped in the face by Super Size Me and then burned the shit out of an elderly woman with their boiling coffee. Tim says, "Wah-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha! I'm peeing from laughing too hard." Hey, thanks very much, Rob. Rob just took us down to $55 to go for this evening's fundraising. Thank you intensely, Rob. Can we do the rest in 8 minutes' time? I don't know. I hope so. I like to send good news back to Shirley. Mark pointing out, I played Working Class Hero at CR3 during morning stretches with a crowd of 90 union workers, Teamsters, operators, electricians, laborers, carpenters. It hadn't been heard by most of them, though it did become very popular. Mark notes Nixon had Lenin on the list for deportation. Threat to national, it'll threat to national security, Henry. They don't understand me. Lenin's last political act was supporting sanitation workers in San Francisco in 1980. Wow. A very interesting and very busy Moran Monday, to say the very least. That leads, of course, inexorably into Titanic Tuesday, which comes our way tomorrow. And we will have, I have no doubt, more examples of the Titanic intellect ever present in the cogitation of the right wing. Thanks y'all very much for tuning in, for sharing your ideas, your emails, your thoughts, the emails you will send when you hear this in podcast form. Thank you. For now, I think it's time to shut things down and take my feet that do not any longer have feeling in them out of the frozen studio. Yeah, we got heat in here, but, you know, cold air sinks. And, I don't know, stick them under the covers or something. Oh, okay, note coming in from Robert in Australia. Bob, I haven't been into a McDonald's in over 25 years. I refuse to do so on principle, plus I dislike the, quote, food, unquote. As a great British comedian once said, McDonald's, flush it straight down the toilet and out of the middle, man. Oh, I'm sorry. I can't read very well. Flush it straight down the toilet and cut out the middle man. And if you've never seen the film McLibel, it's worth tracking down, Robert says. McDonald's in the UK decide to sue two UK protesters for passing out nutritional info about their food outside their restaurants. something the protesters would have legally been allowed to do in the USA. McDonald's won the case but lost the battle as their actions backfired on them politically. People in the UK were pissed off by a giant U.S. corporation beating up on two little U.K. protesters. I'm familiar with that story, and yeah, it was shameful, but all too typical corporate behavior. So thanks for that. All right, then. Thanks go out always, first and foremost, to those of you who keep this whole endeavor afloat with your kind contributions. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening, for sharing in the conversation, for participating in it however you so choose. Because that's what makes the community work that we have built here. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox, who, if I understand his Facebook feed correctly, is busting ass down in Australia. Keep at it, John, and thank you. And thanks, of course, to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Ben Birch started the White Rose Society in 2002. And he continues to be one of the primary outlets for progressive radio in the world. And what's more, he does it and he has never sent a bill. Late breaking news. Thank you to Michael for taking us down to only $25 to go to finish Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. Thank you very much, Michael. Thanks always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and ACACT, ACHEACT.org, ACACT.org. Go there, go to ACACT.org, and learn how you can be a part of passing the ACACT and ending Appalachia's ongoing agony. ACACT.org. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.